because it's too hot there. So I'm going to see the other one of the questions at Roswell. Basically, I'm here to give you a very fast overview of breast cancer. Feel free to ask some questions as we go along, or any questions at the end is totally fine as well. Okay, so we're going to go through a bunch of things today. There's a lot of information. Breast cancer treatment is changing very quickly. That's probably, when you get here, we'll probably go through a lot of the more recent research or things that are changing. I can also briefly go over the article with you that I sent out, or I had sent out, which is a little bit of an older article that actually was what we call breast cancer. So it extremely changed my practice in how we treat certain aspects of breast cancer. And so I thought it was a pretty good article for that. But today we're going to talk about what to look for when you are doing breast exam in the history and physical, what the screening guidelines are, what different risk factors for breast cancer are, what we might do for people who are at higher risk for breast cancer. Then we're going to talk about masses and cells, and then treatments of breast cancer, and then some special considerations that we have to do that we can see either cancerous or not. Okay. Sorry. Okay, so breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed form of cancer in females. It is not the most common cause of cancer death. What's the number one cause of cancer?
Lung.
Okay, so lung is always number one. And then breast is most commonly diagnosed for females. Prostate is most commonly diagnosed for males, but lung is the number one cause of cancer death, at least at this point in time. Okay, so 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in North America. Okay, these numbers are going to differ depending on where you go, and it does differ, as you'll see, by race as well, but in general, 1 in 8 women, which is about 12 to 13%. Again, most common cancer in females, second leading cause of cancer-related death, so lung number one, breast number two. But we have made huge significant advances in the treatment of breast cancer and the ability to screen for the disease. So really, breast cancer in and of itself is a fairly curable form of cancer. I should make a side note that I absolutely hate the word cure. Patients ask me all the time, am I cured of cancer? Am I cancer free? If I could tell you that you were absolutely cured of cancer, you would never have to give it a second thought again. Unfortunately, cancer patients always have to think about whether they come back or not. And so I think the word cure is a huge misnomer. If you find a cure for cancer, it means that you've done something where you will never have to think about that part of cancer again. You guys find it? All money to you, I'm letting go of this myself. Okay, but until then, let's talk about what we look for in history and physical. So, you know, in your history of present illness, you want to ask a lot of different questions. These are specifically focused on breast cancer itself. So you want to ask, you know, if you don't know already when they had their prior screening, if they've had any abnormal imaging before, so what do they tell you? You know, a couple of years ago they were looking at a lump in my breast. You want to know about that. You want to know if they have any particular breast complaints at this particular time. Do they have any nipple discharge, pain? Do they feel any masses of cells? Have they had any prior biopsies? This is important as well. You want to talk about family history. Okay, so particularly we're interested in breast and ovarian cancer, but there are other cancers that are also related. You want to ask about their menstrual history. Are they pre or postmenopausal? When did they first start having their period? Also, how many children they've had or how many times they're pregnant. You kind of want to know about their estrogen life on them, okay, in some ways. Other cancer treatments that they might have gone through, so if they've received chemotherapy before, have they received radiation to their chest or Hodgkin's lymphoma or something like that, these are important points to know. And then review systems, we concentrate a lot on review systems that is basically related to cancer and whether you have cancer metastases. You want to talk about unintentional weight loss. You want to talk about new pain in the muscles or bones, unexplained fatigue, headache, dizziness. Any sort of new symptoms from their prior 6 month history. Okay, if they constantly have muscle and bone pain, that's really not as much of a concern. Okay, so when we talk about physical exam, the first thing that I tend to examine is the lymph nodes just because one exam is them both upright and when they're laying down. So the first thing they're usually looking upright when they're appointment. So when you're talking about lymph nodes, you want to look at a couple different phases. You want to feel the cervical lymph nodes, so higher than the neck. You want to feel the supraclavicular, so just above the clavicle, you can feel that area, also intraclavicular. I'm not going to lie to you, you generally don't feel lymph nodes in these areas, but every once in a while you do, and they are important to us. And then you want to examine the axillary lymph nodes, are going to be the most common basis that breast cancer goes to. When you're examining the axillary lymph nodes, okay, If you're examining yourself, you kind of put your hands on your hips, so you ask the patient to put their hands on their hips. But you want their muscles to relax down. So a lot of them kind of do like a superhero pose when you get some like let their shoulder relax. Because you want that pec muscle that the breast is lying on to relax. Okay, so guys, obviously, mostly your pec muscle, you know, kind of breast tissue over that. But you're really trying to get up and in under that pec muscle and feel around there. Okay, you want to feel really high up and in there. Patients tell me all the time that I hurt them, that's my job. Okay. It is to be uncomfortable when you're feeling up there. Because lymph nodes, especially if you're a bigger person, you're not going to feel well unless you're really getting in there. Even skinny people, you may not necessarily feel it. Just because you feel a lymph node doesn't mean that it's necessarily suspicious, but when you have that cancer, if you can't feel a lymph node, it's probably really suspicious. Okay? So you want to know, are they on one side, or both sides? Do they feel mad at you? Is there just a whole bunch of them sitting there that just feel hard? So patients open up to you just like that. It's just super hard, and that's like multiple lymph nodes that are back together. Maybe you just feel one big one, maybe you just feel a couple small ones on both sides, so it's just going to be active tissue, which you want to talk about or know about all of those. Okay, we're talking about breast exam. You want to examine people both in the upright position and you want to examine them laying down. So mostly first, you also want to look for like contour changes. So in the picture, you see that the woman has her arm raised up and lowered down. When the arm is raised up, you're going to see that things kind of come and they pop out a little bit more because basically her chest is opening up, right? And things are coming out. Or you may notice that if you're looking, you know, when you're looking at both breasts, you want to look for symmetry. People are not always symmetrical, but general symmetry, I mean. So if you have a really large mass in the lower portion of one side of the breast, it may like kind of completely flatten that breast in a lot of ways. And you might not have noticed it if they're sitting like this, but when they kind of like stretch out and have a chest a little bit more open, you're going to notice contour changes. You want to also notice skin changes, okay? Do they have like Peyronie's changes? Do they have erythema in any area? Is one nipple inverted or versus the other side? Those sort of things. When you're examining the breast, there are multiple ways to do it. Pick one and be consistent, okay? So most of the time, most people use kind of the spiral method. And when you're examining breast tissue, it's not just kind of in that central area. It goes all the way up to your clavicle, all the way over to your side. So be sure to examine that entire area, not just kind of where you think breast tissue might be. For guys, if you're examining them, because yes, breast cancer, breast cancer too. About 1 in 100. So for every 100 females that get breast cancer, men get breast cancer. Why might they get breast cancer, okay? When we talk about breast tissue on men, generally we're talking about 2 to 3 centimeters. From around the nipple. So men don't really have breast tissue all the way up here, they tend to be in a more concentrated area, but for females, they don't have all over that area. You also want to squeeze the nipple to see if there's any discharge, especially if they're complaining of it. If they're complaining of it and you cannot get discharge out, ask them to squeeze the nipple because they often don't have to take them out. The other day, I'm not gonna lie, I was on the grocery store this week, but it literally squirted out and like over everywhere. It doesn't actually come out quite like that, but you're screaming and it comes out of like little drips, but that would be kind of lost this hurt. Okay, so again, size and symmetry are things to look for. Contour, you see dimpling, you see flattening of any surface of the breast. You want to look for erythema, that Peyronie that is tested widely. Okay, basically the skin is so swollen that it looks like it's an orange peel. Nipples, you want to look for inversion or retraction. If the nipple goes in and out, you can make it come out, then that's not bothersome, okay? Nipple inversion is only a bad for a nice thing, but if suddenly someone has nipple inversion and it doesn't come out again, it might mean that there's a mass behind it pulling it backwards, okay? You want to look for ulcerations of the nipple. It looks super painful, it probably is very painful. Nodules, so if you feel anything during your breast exam, you want to know where it is, about what size you think it is, whether it's mobile or not, and whether it's tender. So the way that we generally tend to do it, just to be simplified, and most breast people do it, you at least need a quad, upper, outer, upper, inner, lower, outer, lower, inner, or if you want to be more specific, we will also say, it's located at 9 o'clock, it's located at 3 o'clock, because the next person who reads your note needs to be able to reproduce this exam, okay? The next person might be, you may not remember it, and then we go, that answer is 3 o'clock, it was 2 centimeters from the nipple, it measured about 4 centimeters, and it was mobile. That's a very good description of a mass, okay? The acne, you want to again feel for nodes, you might want to look for infection. People come to you all the time complaining of acne or masses, and it might actually just be that they have like such spaces that are infected, and different pigmentations, you can see that under there. And then nipple discharge, it's important to talk about color, consistency, which duct is putting it out, if it's one duct versus multiple ducts, if it's one breast versus both breasts. There are different characteristics that we'll talk about. Okay, so here are some abnormal findings. Some of these are my patients, some of these are not my patients. Okay, so if you look at the upper left-hand corner, you can see the breast on the left-hand side is inverted versus the everted nipple. Okay, again, that's not necessarily abnormal if you can get it to come back out, or if they tell you that it's been that way for like 6 years, no one cares. Okay, on the right upper hand corner, that's a picture of an orange peel along with skin that looks edematous, which looks a little bit like an orange peel, so that's classic photoerotic skin, is what we call it. It's really hard to see in that picture of the nipple discharge, but you can see there's actually two dots of discharge there. One is bloody, one is more milky colored. And you can see that it's coming from two different ducts, right? So we have about 12 to 15 ducts in our breast that it can come out of, and that's what they mean. Okay, people have presented like this, that, you know, and I'll tell you, there's the river, the Nile, and the sea. People will come to you. I had a lady who told me that her breasts are tricky. It was tricky and it was gone, basically. It had turned into one big mess for the rest of the week. And she had sometimes successfully been in that for her entire family for years. So these are different changes that you can obviously see. I would describe what's on the left-hand side here as a large one-digit mass. It probably is very friable, bleeding very easily, probably picked up discharge. It's probably not low risk. But you also want to know, see how there's like, down here, there's still like even more skin disease coming down here. You have to talk about that too when you're talking about your exam. So she would have nodules extending lower lateral down the wall with that. Also see how there's some redness here. That's a fungal infection. I see that a lot. Okay. Let's talk about screening guidelines then. So patients just coming in to the PCP and they're having their regular mammogram. When should an average risk woman start screening? You are not a woman. So no family history, nothing else. You're saying 50?
Okay. I have 15.
So you're talking about doing clinical exams. Yeah. So most women will start having those in their 20s. I mean, you can start earlier if you're going to go back earlier, but most women are recommended to start like 5 years. When do you first start getting mammograms for screening?
40.
So 40 is still what's recommended by most of the large groups that are out there recommending this. Okay, there's some controversy.
In the book, we have to read for this course. You said that at the beginning, when they start doing trials to see if mammograms were useful, they discovered that they were only useful for women that were older than 50. Has that changed?
I mean, those trials would be from way back.
Yes.
So let's talk about screening guidelines. Let me see if I answer your question there a little bit. Okay. So this is the American, well, that's it. Okay. So basically the recommendation that has been there for years is to start at 40. Okay? 40 or 10 years before the age of the first person in your family to have had breast cancer. So if my aunt had breast cancer at 40, then I started at 30. Okay? But generally 40 and generally then every year thereafter. However, there have been new guidelines that have come about. So actually this is like a huge thing that came about a year and a half ago. It caused a lot of controversy and a lot of confusion that are out there. But essentially the American Cancer Society has decided that they are not recommending that you start necessarily at 40. They said you can start between 40 and 45, and they said that they're recommending screening mammograms every other year. Okay? All the other large groups aside from the American Cancer Society are still recommending starting at the age of 40 and starting every year. The reason for this is because even with So they're saying start at age 45. They're saying you can start at 40, but you don't have to start at 40. But just begin starting at 45 and then at 55 to go to every other year. And then they say continue as long as you're in good health. So a large reason why this sort of changed was, or why they're making this recommendation, is because when they look at all the women who get mammograms, And they look at how many women have what we call false positives, right? So they're called back, they get a biopsy or something. And then they look at the cost of that, they look at how anxious women get when they get called back for biopsies and everything. They think that the overall cost to society is higher, and therefore would be better served to go every other year. It does not mean that an individual benefits by going every other year versus every year. Does that make sense? So they're making a system of recommendations. They're saying, well, we take all the mammograms in the United States, we look at how many women are falsely biopsied, or not falsely biopsied, but biopsied but not to have cancer. The cost of that, the anxiety of that, all of that is too much of an impact. If we go to every other year, the fact that it won't really change overall if you go to every other year as opposed to every year and kind of look at mortality and things as well. Most women, however, would tell you that they would rather find something earlier than find it a little bit later and are willing to undergo the anxiety and the cost of the biopsy that they had. So this is where there's a lot of controversy with this. Also, the American Cancer Society puts together suggestions. They're not saying it's an absolute. So it'll be interesting to see how the insurance companies who are really the ones to pay for all this stuff will mandate it. On the other hand, though, mammograms are extremely cheap. Okay, as compared to other types of imaging, such as MRIs or even ultrasounds, mammograms are super cheap and they're very, very effective. So maybe there won't be much change in blood depletion. We talked about how effective mammograms are. Okay, so for every 1,000 women who have screening mammograms, 100 of them will be called back and have some sort of additional imaging. So that's 10%, right? For that 100, 20 of those are going to be aware. That's 2%. And then out of those, 5 are going to be diagnosed with breast cancer. So you still have to screen a humongous amount of people to find breast cancer. But knowing that your screenings are relatively safe, so many parents, I've heard or not, but these are really pleasant, but they don't really, there's no long-term effects to it really. You get a tiny amount of radiation, you know, it's still worthwhile overall. So when we talk about mammograms coming into existence as a regular feature of screening, it has really reduced breast cancer mortality by at least a third. It's not really reducing breast cancer mortality as much anymore. You're not seeing decreasing levels because we've hit the plateau. Okay, if everyone got screening, you'd be at the plateau, you're just at it already. And then the flip side of this is our mammograms catching things that we don't need to really worry about. So you've heard that I'm not really talking about this too much, but there's a lot of controversy about whether DPI is or not a cancer is considered a cancer or not. Kind of even had a whole thing which made a lot of my patients really anxious and confused, but basically they said, is DPI even really cancer, which we still consider a cancer. But mammography is catching a lot of DPI tests, and it is possible that FDA does not caught it, that those patients will be fine. It is a little bit possible depending on what we're talking about. This is in the form of DPI. Okay, so this may be a mammogram where obviously there's something different. So this is what we call a fairly relatively fatty replaced breast. So another reason not to do mammograms is women who are younger, or because women who are younger tend to have dense breasts. That's just a function of age. So if you have a really dense breast, if you take an x-ray of your leg, the bone is really dense, it shows up as white. Dense things also show up as white. So if you have a dense breast, and this were all white, you would probably not be able to see that mass right there. Because this breast is relatively fatty replaced, you can clearly see it. And that does tend to be older women having fatty breasts as we go on. You see a little triangle sitting over the mass, that means, like, the radiology symbol for the fact that they can feel something. So they kind of, if you can feel something, they'll put something on top of it so that they can tell that this is corresponding to whatever it is you feel. We have something called a BI-RADS scoring system. Okay, this is for radiologists, but essentially when you read a report, it'll say BI-RADS 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and it gives you an idea of whether more workup needs to be done or not. Okay, so 0 means it's an incomplete workup, you need more information. If it's normal, then the chance of you still will miss breast cancer, but the chance of it being there is really low. If you have a benign mammogram, that means that they saw something on it, but they didn't see cancer, so they're not that worried about it. If they see something that's probably benign, they're probably going to make you come back and take a look at it again to make sure that it's not growing or suspicious. If it does grow in that period of time, it looks different than the biopsy of 6 months. Then they have highly suspicious, so they recommend biopsy, or they think it's, you know, definitely suspicious, or it's already a known cancer, then this is what they'll recommend for that. The other thing is about stent breasts, okay? Stent breasts are if you, and then again, this is in just a little bit, or if you have any relatives who have immigrants who might have stent, why are we suddenly being told that we have stent breasts? So in 2013, New York State passed a law that said that if you have stent breasts in family, you're going to have to be told about that. So patients who previously never did that were being handed a screener that said they had stent breasts. We do know that stent breasts may increase the risk of breast cancer a little bit, but it also, as I said before, makes it more difficult to find cancer. So they have to be told that, and then they may be offering other screening to go along with that. And so you might offer an ultrasound MRI or tomosynthesis, or what we call 3D mammograms, or also for stent breasts. So if they feel it's appropriate, you can do that as well. Okay, let's talk about risk factors for breast cancer then. So what are some risk factors for breast cancer? What puts you at a higher risk for breast cancer? Age, definitely. So as you age, your risk goes up. Who is your risk factor? Okay, so does it having more pregnancies, or does it having less pregnancies make you more likely to have breast cancer?
When you're
less. Less likely. So if you have no children versus someone who has three children, your risk is higher. Okay. Also, so think of it this way. If you have more estrogen in your lifetime, you are at a slightly higher risk of breast cancer. Okay? So that means if you started your period earlier, if you had menopause later, these are all minor risk factors, but they're still there. If you took hormone replacement therapy, if you're talking about kids, okay, I'm sure pregnancy is a whole whirlwind of hormones, so I'm not going to say you have less estrogen in your body. However, every child you have, you can think of your body as coming out of the estrogen cycle for a year. That's how I think of it, so it's before you do it. So the more children you have, the less estrogen you have in your body. Okay. What are some other factors for breast cancer? Absolutely. Hugely increases your risk. There are also a bunch of other gene increases that are increased, so we'll talk about that. Actually, it's probably on the next slide. Okay, so let's talk about it. The number one risk factor for breast cancer is the DNA. Okay, but that's the thing, right? I'm sorry. Even males with BRCA are at a lower risk of breast cancer in their lifetime than the average female. So being female, by far, age is number two. Okay? If you have a family history, people think this is the only thing that matters. It's part of it, obviously, but it's not just family history. But family history of breast or brain cancer is going to increase your risk. Your weight is going to increase your risk. So, compared to a Caucasian female, is an African American female higher or lower risk? Lower. African American females are at a lower risk of breast cancer. They do, however, tend to present at a later stage. So they have a higher mortality from breast cancer, but their actual risk of breast cancer tends to be lower.
So they have triple negative more
cortisol. Say again.
So they have triple negative more.
They do tend to have more aggressive breast cancer as well. Absolutely. What about Asian females? Higher or lower? It's lower. Is it because they eat soy? I eat no soy. I'm a carnivore for that. It's not because they eat soy. We have no idea. I mean, it's rare. Okay. What about Ashkenazi Jewish females? I'm going to tell you something that's embarrassing to me, but I'll help you remember this fact. I had thought, when I went to medical school, we talked about Ashkenazi Jewish people all the time. Okay, they are at higher risk for all sorts of different things. Right? So I had thought, well, I know tons of Jewish people, but I don't know any Ashkenazi Jewish people. They must be like this super small set that, for whatever reason, keeps intermarrying and getting their gene mutation wherever they are. Okay, that is totally not true. Ashkenazi Jewish people refers to any Jewish people who are not of Middle Eastern descent. So almost every Jewish person you tend to think of as being Jewish in America, being filler, that's not really into my whole reason. Okay, but they are all Ashkenazi Jewish, okay? I happen to have said this in a journal club, where I literally said I never met anyone Ashkenazi Jewish, and the person in the journal club stood up and said, I am Ashkenazi Jewish. Super embarrassing. He left the room, and everyone was like, oh my god, you didn't know that either. And I was like, of course, no one's getting up when I say it, but when he leaves the room, everyone admits that they don't know what that is. Ashkenazi Jewish people are the majority of Jewish people, okay? Okay, other things. If you have previous radiation to your chest, okay? If you have, you can't change your menstrual history. We're talking about things that cannot really change again, genetic factors. If you had treatment with VES, or basically if your mom had treatment for VES while she's having kids, so VES, used to be a treatment for infertility, okay? So they were treating it, and then they found out that actually going on that side effects to it, so no longer given for that. But it's not something you'll see commonly anymore, because VES is quite a lot of them, but so on. Okay, risk factors that can be controlled, okay? But put you at risk. Obesity, huge, okay? The more body mass index you have, the more body fat you have, the more place there is for estrogen to be stored, in which case the higher amount of estrogen that's kind of in your body. If you increase your exercise, you can increase your risk of breast cancer as well as a bunch of other things. If you breastfeed, it's supposed to lower your risk of breast cancer. If you drink less alcohol, so if you drink a lot of alcohol, you may affect the processing of estrogen in your liver, okay? So it has to be quite a bit of alcohol, but that still can help it. Take hormonal replacement therapy. Birth control pill, a little bit less of an area, especially with modern-day birth control pills, because you have a lot less hormones than we used to, so you don't really consider risk factors at all. Not anything. Of course, you can have a day of your risk factors. That's not really going to do that, but you can. Okay, and this gives you a general idea of how much to change your risk. So, everything, the things that we're talking about tend to be fairly minor as compared to like a genetic condition, but still can cause your risk to change. So you can see genetic mutation increases it by 200, but everything else is lower than women. Okay, there are some models that you can use to help find out if you're at higher risk or not. These are simple and they're available online. You're all young, but it's super free to start putting yourself online to see what your risk of different things are, or maybe super free to get to age. Okay, so you can do this easily. There's something called the Yale model, and it asks you simple questions to see whether you're at higher risk or not. Yale is probably the most well-known model and the most well-validated model to find out if you're at higher risk. It's not a perfect model. It's really for women who are at average risk. So if you kind of want to know if you're higher in the general population, you can put that in. There are other models that we use for people who have more extensive family history and stuff like that. None of these models are perfect because they're not as well-validated, but we can look at that and use them to help us identify. This is what the Yale model looks like online. Super easy to use. So, generally speaking, over the age of 35, your 5-year risk of breast cancer is about 1.6%. So, the general population is under 1.5 at a certain age. And then again, 1 in 8 women, or about 13%, is lifetime risk. So, if you are higher than that, and you put yourself in the model, you are at higher risk of the general population. It doesn't mean you're super high risk. Okay, so let's talk about breast cancer, and then let's go back to some other situations. So how does breast cancer usually present? It actually usually, hopefully in the same age, presents on a mammogram. Okay, so not a woman feeling anything herself, not having very nipple discharge, not someone who has one breast that's clear and one breast not, it happens. But for the majority of my patients are coming in because they have nothing to see on the mammogram, so it's abnormal, and that's what came in. So you can see a mass, you can see calcification, you can see just something asymmetrical that doesn't quite look the same on the other side. You can see a density, okay? They can come in with a palpable mass. They might come in with breast pain, although most breast pain is not related to breast cancer. I see a ton of women with breast pain, and while I can maybe not tell them how to get rid of the breast pain or what's causing it, I can tell them that it's not cancer, okay, most of the time. They might have nipple discharge presenting as this. They might have just redness of their breasts, thinking that they have an infection or something. They might have changes to their nipple, like we talked about. They might just feel something under their arm, but people do present that way as well. Or they have like ulcerations or other changes to their skin. So what do you do after the history is revealed? So you've done that, you're sitting in your clinic. What else can you do? Well, you want, of course, to mammogram or do something else if they haven't had that already. If you can feel a mass, an ultrasound is a really, really good test. So if you can feel a mass, ultrasound is the number one diagnostic test that you can do. Okay? Because if I can feel it right here, there's an ultrasound right down on it, I can really get what the characteristics look like. You can use MRI as well. We'll talk about when we use MRIs in a minute. You can use CTs, PET-CT, bone scan. All of these tend to be more along the way once you diagnose cancer, but these are all imaging modalities. Tomosynthesis, or what we call 3D mammograms, are starting to become more popular. They help us to look at dense breasts in a through dense breasts better. So if you have a super fatty, displaced breast, what goes pretty much in fat filled breasts, maybe not necessarily being trauma-sensitive, but it's helpful for women who have cancer breast. You can do some labs as well, although there is no lab yet that will possibly be a breast cancer. When you discover it, let me know so I can invest in it. But whatever is the equivalent of the PSA, the PSA, everyone's looking for it, okay? And it will help because then you can just get an early blood test to see if you're high for something, right? You can, of course, biopsy the lesion as well, which is what we do with colon cancer. You can do what's called a punch biopsy, which definitely violent, but it's actually less violent than the core biopsy. A punch biopsy, you're taking a piece of skin. A core biopsy uses a gun that kind of makes a huge noise and it's very startling. Okay. So, if you're looking for something specific, a mammogram is good. It has what we call good sensitivity and specificity. It's also inexpensive. So mammograms in general will catch breast cancer about 90% of the time. So not perfect, but about 90% of the time. Ultrasound, we don't use ultrasound for screening very often. Some places do it, but it's a really difficult test because it's very much dependent on the person who's doing the ultrasound and the person who's reading it. So if you've ever been in a baby ultrasound, you can see when they're putting a probe on it, they just move their hand a little bit, look like a boy, nope, look like a girl. Okay, and they're not even moving their hand at all. So you can imagine how difficult it is to do it on breast. But it's really, really good for palpable masses, unless you have breast cancer, or if you're looking at something specifically, you would look at an ultrasound. So if you see something on the mammogram, you'll try to localize it with an ultrasound as well. MRI, again, is good for dense breast. It can help you, we often use it as an additional modality to make sure we're not missing anything else. We often use it for women who are high risk of screening in addition to mammograms. But it's expensive, it requires contrast, it's a claustrophobic, it's difficult. And it has a high chance of finding things that are not cancer. So it's really good at finding things that are cancer, but it's not very specific. Okay? So it doesn't rule out things that are not cancer. So anytime a woman has their first MRI for their breast, they have about a 40% chance of getting called back for something on the MRI. And that's a pretty high risk. So we don't use this in the general population because we do not want to be biopsied when it's like that, but we use it for people who are high risk. Okay, so on the left here, you can see this is a very dense mammogram, actually, okay? So, I mean, not dense back here, but dense in this area here. So you can imagine, you can have a small, tiny mass just sitting right there. You'll never know it, okay? Unless you do something else. This is an ultrasound, so it's looking at, you know, density in the area. They'll talk about shadowing behind it and all of that. They'll talk about whether it's irregular or not. And I think that's another. This is an MRI. MRIs are like 3,000 images of the other. So this is just one image of the MRI. You can see here a mass there. It also looks at your chest wall and your lymph nodes very well. Okay? Mammograms don't look at the lymph nodes. Ultrasound do not look at the lymph nodes unless you're specifically looking at that area. Okay, if you're doing a biopsy in this area, there are a couple different things that you can do. You can do what's called an FNA, or a fine needle aspirate. Okay, this is a very small gauge needle that pulls out some of the cells into a fluid and then exams the fluid. This is not really what we generally like to use because it's not diagnostic. It can be non-diagnostic. So you can pull it out and it'll say malignant cells, or it may say benign cells, but if you use a core biopsy, you're literally taking a piece of tissue right out of the vest with sweet teeth, okay? And so it's a larger needle though. It's going to be a little bit more painful. It's a little bit more invasive than the FNA is, but it's more worthwhile for us because we can get markers off of it. We can tell the histology off of it. We can tell pathology. So it's a lot more important to us. Usually we try to do it with what we call ultrasound guided, so if you can see the mass on ultrasound, that's the easiest way to do it. If you can't see the mass on ultrasound, you need to do a classification or something, then you might do what's called a stereotactic biopsy, which means that you use the mammogram to do it. You can use an MRI one if it's for MRI, but we try not to do that because it's quite difficult to do. If none of those are possible or they're not diagnostic, a surgical biopsy might be recommended. That means that taking surgery to get through the tissue. We try not to do that unless we really absolutely need to, because you want to have more information than that when you do surgery. Okay, so this is a stereotactic biopsy. It doesn't look fun. You lay there, one leg is pushed up, the other one sitting in a hole, okay? Then it gets anesthetized, sort of. Then a needle kind of goes in. They wait, they have to take a picture, make sure they're in the correct place, and she takes pieces of the visual. Super, super fun. As we say, this was invented by a man, okay? And then an ultrasound guided biopsy. So a little bit easier to do an ultrasound guided biopsy, you're not. It's just a more comfortable procedure overall. Okay, so when we talk about the breast ductal and lobular system, so the most common kind of breast cancer is breast cancer that comes from the duct, okay? 80% of breast cancer comes from the duct. Give or take 20% come from a lot. There's also other kinds of recipes that come from hybrids that are very rare. So when we talk about what is a lot of what is a duct, so we have about 12 to 15 lotule duct systems within each breast. That's not quite the correct word, but so lotules are where you make the breast milk. Okay, so those are lotules back there, and then the ducts are actually just the tunnels leading toward the nipple. Okay, so you can see kind of here, the nipple's here, but it's all made back here and kind of flows forward. Then there's a lot of fat in the breast as well, and then the pectoralis muscle and the meat of your ribs put in there. So you can have other things that come up on your biopsy other than just cancer, not just benign cancer, but that's what a lot of things in between. So when the pathologists are looking at it, they might see a normal duct, they might see what we call intraductal hyperplasia, which doesn't really increase your risk of breast cancer or anything, but basically build up of normal tissues. So hyperplasia doesn't mean more than normal, but it doesn't mean abnormal. Then when you talk about atypical, then you're having a buildup of atypical cells. If you have atypical cells that are all just still within the duct itself, this is called ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS, what we're talking about before, non-invasive breast cancer. And then when they see that it's penetrated the basement membrane and it's gone elsewhere, if it's already invaded elsewhere, this is invasive breast cancer. Even when you have cells that are atypical, we still take these patients to surgery and take the tissue out, because they still have about a 10% chance of having cancer there. Meaning that when you are looking at cancer cells, okay, it's not abnormal to find as neighboring cells that just have atypical cells in the area. So what we worry about is that we actually dismiss the cancer on our biopsy, it can only be atypical cells. Sometimes some other time that's true, and that's how we can use surgery to get a better biopsy. Okay, so really this is just another schematic that's relatively the same thing. So you see you know, the lobules here, the ducts here, and then really looking at how it progresses here to be cancer. So there's some, again, that are still just within the duct itself, and then once it's penetrated outside, it's going to be invasive or infiltrating, whatever you want to call it. Okay, so there's ductal carcinoma in situ, which is the non-invasive cancer. It's increasing in incidence as we go along with screening mammography. So I told you screening mammograms are picking up DCIS more and more. This is super early stage breast cancer, what's called phase zero. Okay, it has an excellent prognosis. So at the 5-year survival marker, it's like 98%. Even at 10 years, it is. So basically, as long as you get it out of the breast, it you shouldn't die of it. Okay? Does it become infiltrating or invasive cancer? The answer is sometimes yes, and sometimes no. We don't have the full answer to that yet. Meaning that DCIS is super heterogeneous. This is a key area of research trying to figure out which ones will become invasive cancers and which ones won't. And that will help us actually a lot of treatment. When we find that, again, I want to invest in your company, so that I can retire young, quicker than I already am. Okay, so that's DCIS. Then you have infiltrating or invasive ductal cancer, you have lobular cancer, and then there are some other ones as well called tubular, mesenteric, and tabular. Those tend to be a little bit more rare. So the two major ones are ductal and lobular. Okay? When we talk about staging of breast cancer, staging of breast cancer is becoming less important to us overall. Okay? So what that really means is that even though we talk about this TNM staging, which is if guys have had any other, I'm sure you've had other lectures where they talk about TNM. So tumor nodes metastasis, sorry, TNM, not TNM, this is where we are. So tumor is always how big is the tumor? Is it just in situ? Is it less than 2 centimeters, 2 to 5? The way to describe it, okay? Nodes, do you feel one node here? Do you feel nodes up in superficial areas? Do you have nodes on the inhalant area, which you don't usually feel, but you see on imaging? That's all important for us to know. And then you have disease that is known as well. Can you feel disease as well? Probably not, but on imaging or anything else. This is less important to us as we talk about breast cancer, because now we treat breast cancer based on the biology of breast cancer as opposed to how far it's gone. And that's a key concept that has been changed for breast cancer treatment in the last even 5 years. Okay? So I would have told you 5 years ago when I was in my fellowship that anyone who had a 1 centimeter breast cancer automatically got chemotherapy, it didn't matter what kind of breast cancer it was. Now I would tell you that a 1 centimeter breast cancer with certain characteristics may be sent off for additional testing to see that you benefit from it or not. So there's a lot of different treat breast cancer just based on this anymore. We treat it based on other factors we're looking at. Okay, so more traditional prognostic factors, though, how many lymph nodes are positive, so generally we did want to know that, and that used to be the most powerful prognostic factor. So it would tell me what this, if you told me you had one lymph node positive or no lymph node positive, you have a much less chance of dying of the disease than someone who has 7 nodes positive, 40 nodes positive, obviously the disease would probably be much further there. Size used to be the second most important factor. I mean, so these are still important things, but not necessarily the way we treat breast cancer. You can also look at the grade of breast cancer. The scarf blue Richardson or color non-hand classification is probably the most common for that. Okay, and then just to give you an idea of breast cancer survival by what we call the near term. The Committee on Cancer. So this is the group that is what came out with the CNN meeting. And I'll just tell you here in their 8th edition. The 8th edition has completely changed the way they look at breast cancer because it includes all the other prognostic factors that we look at. Most people aren't using the AGCC 8th edition yet because it's so different that we're not ready for it. So we still use the AGCC 7th edition, which is pretty much standard. But you can see for stage 0, 1, 2, 3, as you go along and go along in years, 0 and 1 obviously have very, very good prognosis. Even 2 and 3 have pretty good prognosis, but obviously 4 will be also important. Lower are relatively tend to live what we call metastatic disease a lot longer than they used to. So we have a lot more treatment for that as well. Okay, biomarkers. So these are the things that we really look at and can tell us a lot about the cancer. So the three main ones we look at are the estrogen, the progesterone, and then what we call the human epidermal growth factor, or we just call it HER2 for short. Okay? People are constantly looking at research for more biomarkers that will tell us both whether patients are more aggressive or less aggressive. So if there's a biomarker for DCIS that would tell me that it's going to become invasive, that's fine. Find that one. Or if you find something that is what we call a targetable biomarker. So is it a marker that will tell me about cancer, but also I can do something about it? That's really the goal of research as well. So all three of these, the ERPR and HER2, are all what we call targetable biomarkers. So estrogen, progesterone. Generally, if you're estrogen and progesterone positive, these are more favorable, okay? And they tend to be slower growing, less aggressive cancers overall. And most breast cancers are estrogen and progesterone positive. So again, if you know anyone in your life who's ever had breast cancer, they tell you I have a hormone positive breast cancer, then that's really good for you, okay? If they tell you they have a hormone negative breast cancer, if they have what we call a triple negative breast cancer, that means that they're negative for all three of those, and those tend to be more. The HER2 is a newer marker. Not really new, it's still been around for quite a while, but it's newer than the estrogen and progesterone. So the HER2 is a more aggressive marker. So if you have it, you have a more aggressive marker in general. When they first discovered it, they could see if people refer to positivity, they die faster, they have more cancer, it's spreadable. Now we have specific targeted treatments for the HER2 that have completely changed the prognosis for these people. So, if you have HER2 positive cancer, you want to get those treatments to improve your prognosis. But most people would say HER2 positive cancer, so if your ERPR is negative, but HER2 positive, you have a better prognosis than someone who is triple negative, meaning you're negative for all three. Okay. And then you don't say that. There are some other biomarkers that we sometimes look at, but these are not really targetable. They don't really tell us that much yet. So we don't do much with these, but if you're reading about breast cancer, you might hear about KF67 or CD1. And a bunch of other ones that are coming out. But there's none of them are really targetable yet, at least that we know of. I mean, there's nothing that we can give that'll help it. It doesn't really tell us much about it. Okay. So then talking about breast cancer and metastasis, let's talk about where it goes to. Really four major places: the lung, the liver, the brain, and the bone. Really just these four. And really we don't look for this disease until patients are at least about a stage 3, or if they have stage 2 cancers with very bad prognostic features, like a tumor that is late stage 2 breast cancer. Okay? Just because you have a scan, that doesn't mean you have any disease elsewhere. So let's say I have breast cancer, okay? It's a stage 1 or stage 2, or even a stage 3 breast cancer, okay? So it's really large and nasty. I was in that river of denial, and I just let it go. If I go and have a scan, a CT scan or a PET scan or whatever, it doesn't show any kind of disease anywhere else. Does it mean that there's no disease anywhere else in my body?
No.
It doesn't, right? So So when we talk about treating breast cancer, you're talking about treating breast cancer that you can see and you know about, it's in your breast or your lymph nodes, but you're also talking about treating breast cancer that might be anywhere else in the body. So if I have 5 cells of breast cancer sitting in my liver, it's not going to rob me at 5 cells. 5 cells are super tiny microscopic. You want to keep it at 5 cells, though, or you want to kill it all together, okay? You don't want to convert 100 cells, 1,000 cells, 10,000 cells, and then the end. I'm having to get help from my liver, and that's what's going to kill you, not what's going to kill you. Okay? So, even if we stage patients and we scan them to make sure they don't have disease elsewhere, we're looking for gross signs of disease, but it doesn't mean that we don't treat what you have to stop disease elsewhere. Okay, so breast cancer treatment, then, what is it? So, there's two major ways to think of it. You have the local treatment of breast cancer, and you have the systemic treatment of breast cancer. So local treatment of breast cancer is going to be the breast and the lymph nodes in that area. Systemic is going to treat any breast cancer cells anywhere in the body. So surgery and radiation are local treatment. Chemotherapy and endocrine therapy are systemic treatment. Local treatments only help the local area. Okay? So I wish I could tell you that just by needing breast surgery, I'm going to get rid of the breast cancer cells here, that it'll affect your liver or your lung. It does. But chemotherapy and endocrine therapy, we know that those things will affect breast cancer cells wherever they may be. So for surgery, you can have a lumpectomy or you can have a mastectomy. So lumpectomy is just taking a smaller piece of tissue, removing your breast cells and being attacked. Mastectomy is when you're removing all of the breast tissue, usually including the nipple and the areola as well. Not everyone is a candidate for lumpectomy, so you can imagine if someone has a really large breast cancer in a relatively small breast, it's not going to look good if you try to remove it. So that's our job as doctors is to sort of look at that. So those people might need mastectomy. But most people are fitted for lumpectomy because we're better at screening it. So if you go regularly for your screening, if you have breast cancer, it should be small and sound. So you should qualify for lumpectomy. Lumpectomy, though, has a higher chance of breast cancer recurrence coming back, okay? But between the two, the survival is the same. So most women who can have a lumpectomy will choose a lumpectomy. Mastectomy has a lower occurrence rate, but obviously is very disfiguring, okay? And then if they go on to have reconstruction or whatever, you know, causes a lot more surgery to go on down the road. We still do central lymph node biopsies where we put a little dye in radioisotope into your breast and we massage until those open so those lymph nodes and we take those lymph nodes out and try to see how many of those are positive before we get into the breast now. Natural lymph node dissections won't take all the lymph nodes out. We generally have to do that if you have a positive sentinel node, except for in the arcolytic guys where you see that now the region has to take care of it. So that was a hugely practical meeting for us. So again, 5 or 6 years ago, you told me that someone had one lymph node out of 4 positive in their sentinel node biopsy. I would think that that's the opportunity to take all the lymph nodes out. Now we don't have to do that if they and then reconstruction, if you have mastectomy, you can have an implant-based reconstruction, you can take tissue from all sorts of parts of your body before you left. Plastic surgeons are created that way. Okay, so breast conservation or lumpectomy, so just taking out a tiny area, whereas removing a mastectomy is removing the entire breast area. Okay. Indications for a mastectomy, so for people who have no choice but to have a mastectomy, if they have lots of PCIS, so you think to yourself, man, PCIS is not a big cancer stage 0 super early, why do I just have a whole breast removed? That's really super, super difficult for people to understand. But if you have a whole breast full of PCIS, and then sort of take all of the cancer out, which might be removing all of your breast, okay? If you have cancer in multiple areas of your breast, so if you have two tumors that are inside each other, that's fine, they're kind of in the same area. If I have a tumor up here in the upper outer quadrant and I have one in the lower inner quadrant, well, you have to kind of assume that they might be related, that there's cancer between them. You cannot really use the rest of them. That's another reason. If you have a large, so when I was in dental surgery training, they told us, oh, your breast cancer is about 5 centimeters. That's about where you're going to start taking and have a mastectomy. That's really not true. There are women out there with just diagonal breasts, right? So they can lose 5 centimeters for them when there are others of us who are not genetically endowed. 5 centimeters would be more on one. So it's really the ratio of breast tissue to your tumor that tells you whether that's okay or not. And that's really experience-based. If you can't receive radiation, so if you have a lumpectomy, almost always the standard is to receive radiation. So if you, for some reason, cannot receive radiation, you are pregnant. You don't want to drive every day for radiation. Radiation is about 4 to 6 weeks of daily treatment. So if you live in the middle of nowhere and you don't want to drive 2 hours every day to get for radiation, then you can make a mess up. If you previously received radiation, a lot of radiation breast, for whatever reason, you probably can't get radiation again, so you should have that testing. If you have, you know, different collagen acids or diseases or whatever, which might not feel well, those are the most radiation either, so that might be a reason. Or, in some cases, patients just might prefer that, and that happens a lot of the times too. They don't want to think about getting cancer again, they don't want to think about going to treatment again, they don't want to think about referring to, there's a lot of fear there going to do that. Okay, so these are super traditional pictures of lumpectomy, okay? So we don't actually do it this way anymore, but most places still do with these like barbaric panels and wires coming out of the breast. And they help to localize the area. So if I can't see most breast cancer, I can't feel most breast cancer, I need something to help me find the area. So these wires are what we use to localize the area, or I want to use these other little radioactive clips to help us find it. But relatively speaking, the breast stays intact. You can see obviously that they're asymmetrical now. This one looks like the one that's been operated on females. In this case, it might look slightly bigger. But, you know, you'll have a scar. The radiation will change your breast a little bit as well. But you can kind of tell there's radiation changes in that angle at the very least. Okay. So again, to give you an idea, this is a mastectomy. Those are the lymph nodes that are generally in the area. This is what it looks like when we do a mastectomy. We're trying not to leave much breast tissue behind. This is just kind of fat behind the skin. Generally, it's kind of like peeling flesh, okay? Like you're losing a peeling mask so that they can do something with it. Or if you don't need a peeling mask, it's going to lose quite a lot of skin. So you're basically just taking the orange out of the skin for a mastectomy. And if you don't have reconstruction, that's a terrible picture of what it might look like. They don't look that bad, but it can't be the way that they look. This is the breast that looks like when it comes out, if you're sparing the skin, so you can see relatively little skin can come out, but the whole entire breast area has sort of come out. And this is someone who has had tissue implants placed, so you can see the two lines for the mastectomy and what they look like with reconstruction. There are different types of mastectomies, okay? There are what we call skin sparing, like you take the nipple, that's probably the most common. You can have what we call nipple sparing mastectomies. So there are different people who qualify for that, but you can leave the nipple behind. It doesn't have any sensation or function, but you can leave it there. It looks pretty good. And that's generally the way people look if they had a nipple sparing mastectomy. So that's the remaining nipple there, but none of the breast tissue on it. Okay, sentinel nose. This is when we inject dye into the breast around the tumor, or even inject around the nipple. It goes over towards the lymph nodes under the arm and tells you which are the first few lymph nodes that cancer would go to. If cancer had not gone to those nodes, so you pull those out and they're negative, then it's probably cancer has not gone to those lymph nodes. If it's positive, then you know that there might be other cancer cells to those lymph nodes. Can you have cancer that goes to other parts of your body that goes to the lymph nodes? Yes, you can. Okay, so just because your lymph nodes are negative doesn't mean it's not going to go to the body. Okay, radiation treatments is the other form of local treatment. These are fairly painless treatments that are well tolerated. They're very, very short. They're about 30 seconds, 60 seconds a day, 5 days a week for about 3 to 6 weeks. It kind of kills off any of the microscopic cells that might still be left in the area, and will decrease the chance that you'll get breast cancer again in this breast by 50%. Okay, so we try to decrease the recurrence chance as much as we can. So if you're having a lumpectomy, this is standard of care. If you're having a mastectomy where you remove the whole breast, there's really not much to radiate if you want to think about it that way. So there are some indications for radiation after mastectomy, but it's not common, okay? If you have greater than 5 cm mass, more than 3 lymph nodes involved, or if it is growing under your skin or under your chest wall, those are reasons for mastectomy, what we call post-mastectomy radiation. Chemotherapy, okay. Chemotherapy is to treat disease that elsewhere, essentially, okay? It can be used before surgery. If you have a really big cancer in your breast and you don't want to have a mastectomy, you can use chemotherapy to shrink it down. If you have lots of nodes that are positive in that area prior to surgery, you can also use chemotherapy to shrink it down. Most of the time, they'll use it afterwards. Definitely for node-positive patients, HER2-positive patients also need it. Triple-negative patients, these are all patients who are automatically working around with chemotherapy. There's something called an Oncotype DX test. This is what a common research is. This is a big breakthrough of research for us as well. An Oncotype DX test is a genomic test that looks at the cancer cells and it helps you to determine whether you benefit from chemotherapy or not. So these are used for patients who are estrogen and progesterone positive, and they have to be lymph node negative and we use it as well. Herceptin, this is a monoclonal antibody that we use for patients who are HER2 positive. So I told you that HER2 positivity is a worse prognostic factor. taking Herceptin, and then other, actually there are multiple treatments for it now, but Herceptin is the main one that we use for Herceptin. The standard regimen is usually what's called anticyclin based. It's given about every 2 weeks. It does increase our follow-up and it's a few patterns. Typically what you can go with is longer. Endocrine therapy, or what some people call hormone therapy, I don't like using that word because it makes it sound like you're getting hormones, because actually you're not getting hormones, you're getting like hormone blockers essentially. But these are for patients who are estrogen and progesterone positive only. So do not give these to triple negative, do not give these to people who are pure progesterone negative, well or not, okay? Tamoxifen is a selective estrogen receptor modulator. It can be either pre or post menopausal women. These are just pills, you take them daily for at least 5 years, up to 10 years now, okay? It can increase your risk of clot in your lung due to endometrial cancer, or increase your risk of cataract formation, especially in postmenopausal women. So these are risk factors or side effects that we worry about. But in general, it cuts down your risk of developing breast cancer anywhere in your body by 50%. So it's pretty worthwhile overall. Aromatase inhibitors, these are drugs that we use in postmenopausal women. It only works in them. It will decrease your bone density, but it does something very similar. It will decrease your risk of breast cancer development anywhere by 50%. So, really worthwhile. Okay, we're going to jump quickly through these because your class is at 5. HER2, obviously, just a little bit more about it. Basically, you want to get to Herceptin for treatment. Okay. Recurrences, they happen locally, regionally, or distant. Mostly it's locally, and so we watch them in a little bit closer in the first couple of years after breast cancer to make sure that we catch them. Okay. Okay. The 11, we already talked about this a little bit. I'm not going to go through high risk screening. This is a little bit more about the genetics, but generally, talking about BRCA and things that you could pay for it. Let me skip over to special cases. Let's talk a little bit about these special cases because they're detectable. Okay, so inflammatory breast cancer. This is a kind of rare breast cancer. It's probably the most aggressive form of breast cancer, okay? So if you've heard of anyone having inflammatory, it's a bad disease. They have a much higher mortality than you see or what I've already shown you. Most of the time, people think that they just have this little breast infection, so they get antibiotics for a while. But when it doesn't go away, their skin becomes really red, it gets this coat of rash, changes to it. It's ordinary again. We usually buy, usually there's a mass in there, but even if there's not a mass in there, if we buy it, it's skin, there's a mass in there. They always get treated with chemotherapy first. Then they always have an entire breast and their lymph nodes removed, which is called a modified radical mastectomy. And then they get radiation. Always, 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 which is always a force for a, what we call inflammatory breast cancer. You should always, always, always check to make sure that they don't have cancer somewhere else beforehand, because 40% of them on diagnosis cancer will have metastatic disease, so that we don't end up doing all the rest of it. Very rare, but very, very aggressive. Okay. Paget's disease, this is on the other end of things. This is when you see weird changes to the nipple. I told you it looks kind of painful, there's like ulceration on it. So this is when you get an ulcerated region on the nipple or the areolar area. If you biopsy it, this tends to be what we call Paget's disease, or it's just VTIS basically is in the nipple areolar area. They may or may not have disease underneath, but that's why you look for changes along the nipple as well. And we treat it as like VTIS. But that might mean that you lose your nipple, even if you lose your breast behind. Hormone replacement therapy of breast cancer. So there is an increased risk of breast cancer with the use of estrogen or estrogen progesterone therapy, which a lot of women do postmenopausally. So before, almost everyone who was postmenopausal went on hormone replacement therapy. You don't do that anymore. But really, it's for how long you use it increases your risk. Okay. And then after you stop using it, your risk does go down over time. So we really discourage use of hormone replacement therapy unless you need it. But certainly, patients with history of breast cancer, especially after progesterone positive, you don't want to use it. Pregnancy, also very a different area for breast cancer. So 20% of women under the age of 30 with breast cancer who are going to have breast cancer usually have around the time that they're pregnant. And really, the incidence is increasing, but that might just be because in general, society has children at later ages. Most cancers are still invasive ductal, but they might have more aggressive features, might be more poorly differentiated, or be ER care negative. There are probably a lot of tumor sizes if these women are not undergoing regular screening. There aren't really any specific risk factors that are known for, so you can't really tell if you get it or not. However, everyone who gets it should have genetic testing done, because they're going to be at the end of the question. It usually presents as a mass, okay? I never heard of this, but I read about it in the health protection plan, so the baby wall turns off from that side. I don't know if it worked out for that reason, but maybe because there's cancer there. You can have ultrasound if you're pregnant. You can have a mammogram if you shield your abdomen. You can have an MRI if you're pregnant. Super weird, but it's true. It seems weird, but it's true, so that should be fine. You can have surgery when you're pregnant. And all kinds of try to avoid the first trimester because that's an unfortunate event that can happen and you don't really want to affect the baby, you can avoid it. But you can have surgery, second or third trimester very safely. You can use radioactive activity to be able to for those lymph nodes that we talked about, which you cannot use blue dye. Okay? That's a big thing in pregnancy and breast cancer. You can't receive radiation while you're pregnant. So if you are in your second, early second trimester and you want to have lumpectomy, you might not really be able to because you might be delaying out your treatment. So that's something to think about in terms of timing. However, what's super weird about this is that you can get chemotherapy after breast cancer. So you would think the opposite, but there are no one's ever going to do a trial where they give some breast cancer patients that are pregnant chemotherapy and some that don't, because no one will ever agree to sign up for that trial. But we do know that there are some chemotherapies that are relatively safe for pregnancy, so it can be used. But you cannot use trastuzumab. Trastuzumab is the other one for Herceptin or for Herceptin therapy. You cannot use that while you're pregnant. You can't use tamoxifen or anything like that. Or a couple of these other ones are really not recommended. But those are the two common ones that we use to treat pregnancy. So radiation is contraindicated. Breastfeeding from the after you've had breast cancer, can you breastfeed from the breast? You can, it's okay. You might not have as much milk, but you can certainly do it. Should you abort a baby if you're pregnant and have breast cancer? Actually, really doesn't show that any outcomes are improved by that. So a woman may choose to do it, but it doesn't mean that they have to do it because they have breast cancer. A lot of women might choose to do it because they feel like they can take care of a child after the, really complicated situation. So, nipple discharge. Another common scenario, okay? So things that make it seem more benign, if it's coming out of both ducts, if it's coming out of multiple ducts, if you can squeeze it out, and it's not just something that you saw in your bra or something like that, it's clear, milky white, if you're under the age of 40, these are all more cancer-associated. If it's only coming out of one breast, it's one duct, it's bloody, it's what we call spontaneous, you either saw in the bra or like you were pushing on the breast or anything like that, these are all more suspicious signs. It should be worked out. The most common cause of blood nipple discharge is an intraductal papilloma. Like there's a super highly tested dental surgery in medical school that, but there you go. And you want to take that out because there may be some cancer associated with it, usually UTIS. Okay. Sorry, I took over 1 minute. Any other questions that I can do that? Okay.
Yeah, of course you can't just let it out. Yeah. With the new system, you have to like move it all the way up, move it all the way back down. Sorry. And I think your batteries are gone for the microphone.
it keeps opening your mailbox. Do you know how to get out of that, or should I just sign you off?
Oh, you can try to sign me off if it's not. Yeah. Let's try these.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what's happening with this computer. It used to be really fast, and then all of a sudden it became really slow.
I always find it pisses me off that anytime you're like the first time you log on.
You can, yeah, that too, we can do that.
Okay.
Is it a HDMI?
It's a browser
laptop. Oh, okay. Yeah.
This might be faster. I can continue to play.
Yeah, as soon as, because we can't blank it, so I don't want, if there's any private emails or anything, or patient stuff or anything like that, I don't want to, yeah.
You can try to set your jump in my back as I go along.
Oh yeah, we could try that. That probably might be the best. Oh, yeah, we can try it. Let's try plugging it in.
I figured you just wanted to do it.
It'll come on as soon as it comes all the way down.
Right. Does it?
It should.
I'm Kazus Kadia, the Chief of Breast Surgery at Roswell. And so Dr. Young did a comprehensive review on breast cancer. So I will spend the rest of the 10 minutes just kind of give you how to collaborate with clinicians. And the reason I'm thinking of doing this is based upon my personal experience. So who am I? So I graduated Japanese medical school, and then I did 1 year of research fellow. At that time, I was interested in legal medicine. I tried to become a CSI, and I thought that was cool. By the way, that was the TV show wasn't in there, so I thought I was ahead of the time. But I did research for a year, and I kind of, I came to the reality that, so at that time I was interested because I wanted to kind of, protect the right of the dead, and, that was my passion. But in the end, I realized that dead people are already dead and can't really save them. So I decided to come to the clinical portion. So if you have noticed, the right side is my research career and the left side is my clinical career. So I started my general surgical residency in Japan. But then after like 3 or 4 years of surgical residency, I came to realize that, surgery is very interesting. They save lives, but basically they're practicing what's already established. If you have noticed the lecture that Dr. Young gave, it's all like observation. Okay, so for this type of inflammatory breast cancer, this was tried, this was tried, this was tried, and apparently that was, that worked, kind of a thing. And I thought, if we wanted to save patients that we can't as of today, well, even a surgeon needs to think. So I went to the grad student school and I got my PhD in molecular biology, and I further did my training, postdoctoral fellow training at Salk Institute at La Jolla, California. But then, one of the great examples how research can save lives is the discovery of HER2 that Dr. Young just described. So HER2, when the breast cancer is overexpressing HER2, biologically that breast cancer is bad, okay? But then people have developed Herceptin that binds to HER2 and inactivates it. And now, the world just like turns upside down, and the most aggressive breast cancer, which is supposed to be overexpressing HER2, now because we have the drug, it becomes a treatable cancer. And it's actually, in the end, after if you use that drug, the prognosis is better. Even biologically, that's a bad cancer. And I thought that was fascinating because, you can turn the world upside down. And that's the power of research. And that was what I was so passionate during my PhD and my postdoc. But then, when I was operating on all those mice, and at that time I was, operating on hemophilic mice, trying to do gene therapy on hemophilics, meaning that the animal who cannot stop bleeding, but obviously I'm a trained surgeon, so I was able to stop bleeding, but I was keep on operating to do the gene therapy, and we end up writing a big paper, but what I realized is not a single mouth said thank you. And I began to question myself, is this what I really want to do? So I came back to the surgical residency and did all the surgical training, and I got a job. But then, when I got the job, I got the both position in surgery and the molecular biology back in VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University. So I did pursue more of my research career while I became the faculty, and I got the K-12 award. This is the, a career development award, and I got the career development award from our foundation, and eventually that led to R01, and another R01 type from the foundation, that gave me the next job, and here I am in Roswell. So I consider myself, I'm a little bit of a hybrid, that I truly live in both worlds of the, you know, clinician and, you know, scientist. So I think I'm in a unique position that I can kind of, you know, introduce you how to do like a successful collaboration. Now, this is the Tower of Babel, and I don't think I need to kind of introduce you about it, but basically, you know, the God get angry and they destroyed it, and, you know, now people have different languages. And the reason I'm showing this picture is, in some way, the clinicians and researchers are a little bit like that, in the sense that they're all speaking English. So it's not about the language itself, but how what it means in terms of what they're talking about, and, you know, the content and all that can be very, very different. And it may not go like, you know, in one way. So, in a nutshell, this is how I see it, is that, for MDs, the clinicians, once they go to a medical school, they get a comprehensive education. They learn physiology, they do pathology, they do pretty much whole field. So if you ask me to see a pathology, like a histological slide, even though my PhD is on molecular biology, I can actually kind of read them. But, you know, on the other hand, what I notice is many PhDs, well, if they get the PhD in molecular biology, that's molecular biology, and they're very focused. But on the other hand, because they're focused, they know the subject a lot more in depth than the people who went to medical school. Because, you know, in medical school they can teach the whole lecture and they can remember them, but they didn't really do it on their own. So it's very shallow and superficial. So what it ends up is that many of the MD researchers are very good at pursuing like physiology or like a phenomenon, what they observe. They're good at grasping those things. But many times the PhD researcher more good at pursuing like mechanism or conceptual novelty or something that really asks a fundamental question. So my point is that when those two get together and work together, that's when the truly innovative research can occur. When I talk to many of my basic researcher friends, you know, many times they kind of consider clinicians as like a sample provider. So I'm a surgeon, I operate on breast cancer, so the researcher says, hey, you must have access to breast cancer. Can I get a little bit of a tissue? Well, that's okay. But first of all, in Roswell, we're lucky enough that we have a procurement department. So the whole department, they're gathering the specimen. So you don't ask me to get the specimen. You just can just ask them, and you can get the whole access. But, you know, this is very superficial interaction. And we can do a lot more than this. And that's what I want to talk about. So this is one of our paper, but, you know, basically, this is the example of give me a sample kind of approach that, do I get a pointer? Maybe not. All right. So basically, we made an animal model, and we're interested in, you know, the cancer and its, you know, metastasis, and basically these 41 cells are known to metastasize. And we were after this, you know, lipid S1P, and compared from sham, yes, you know, when you implant mouse cancer, if this S1P thing was high. So we access to the clinical samples, and yes, indeed, the patients who has lymph node metastasis had a significantly increased S1P compared from the controls. So this is a, you know, the example of give me a sample kind of approach. But, you know, we can do a lot more, and this is one of the examples of a lot more. So, I corroborated with Dr. Heilman and Dr. Zhou. Both of them are basic researchers, a PhD, and Dr. Heilman was a bile acid specialist, and Dr. Zhou was a molecular biologist. And basically, they did a high throughput screening and found that bile acids, that, you know, those acids that comes out from your gallbladder, actually bind to this S1P receptor 2. And I was working on this S1P signaling, so that's why I was called. But this is purely basic research project. But since I was a little bit working on S1P receptor, I got called, but, you know, this is pure basic research. Now, then we come up with a little bit more of a physiological, you know, project, because I'm got involved. You know, I'm an MD. I'm more interested in physiology. I'm interested in disease. And when you hear a bile acid, when do you secrete bile acid? Well, bile acid in my body is gonna get secreted when I eat Big Mac. You know, when I eat something fatty. You know, the liver makes bile acids and is stored in the gallbladder. It's going to squeeze out to digest Big Mac. So my point was that if this, you know, signaling has some relevance, does that have any relevance in digesting fat? And apparently that was the case. So we used a knockout mouse of those receptor and the downstream kinase, and what we discovered is that this bile acid and this receptor signaling had a significant role in lipid metabolism. And once again, this project never occurred unless myself and Dr. Zhou and Dr. Heilman's group never, if we didn't talk. And once again, this was published in like a Hepatology, which is a premier journal in the world of liver disease. But more interestingly, this thing did not stop here. So then Dr. Zhou, the molecular biologist, thought a little bit more. So if the this bile acid and this signaling is so important, can that be some relevance in cancer? And so what kind of cancer gets the bile acid? Of course, the bile duct cancer, because bile duct where the bile acids grow. So she did all the in vitro experiments using the cells, and she found that bile acid and this signaling actually makes the bile duct cancer worse. If you ever realize, you know, I was out of the loop for this particular, project. Because, you know, it was all about mechanism, it's all about the cells. But obviously, being a collaborator, we talk, and, you know, I learn about this, you know, great, study. Then, you know, we chatted, and we talked about, so if that's the case in the cell, basically all the experiment is, you know, on the dish, she was pouring the bile acid on the dish, right? If that's the case, can we do that in an animal? And she said, that's interesting, but, you know, how can we do that? I mean, if we ligate the bile duct just like that in the animal's gonna die. And since we're surgeons, and we're very skilled, and we're, you know, very interested in doing the operations, one of my postdocs, Hiroki Aoki, got interested, and he invented the new model to ligate the bile duct without killing the animal. And in his technique, the model that's been reported, and this is his new model. So we made up a new model with an animal using that model. Well, this is so early that it's EPUB ahead of print, but we did an in vitro study with Dr. Zhou's group which was accepted for hepatology. So this is one example, but you know, this is how I think the way that the PhD can use the clinician. So instead of just, you know, like a sample provider, if we work together, I think we can supplement and complement each other very, very strongly. And this is the opposite direction. So this is Omar Rashid. He's a surgical resident. He's a surgeon. So he's always like interested in surgical topics. And the topic he was interested in was that if you have like a metastatic disease, does it worth removing the breast cancer? And apparently he found by operating, yes, indeed, that prolonged the life. But then, obviously, in order to publish in a good journal, you need a mechanism. How? How does that happen? Then he talked to one of his immunology friends, and the immunology friends told him that if you have a high tumor burden, well, there's a thing called MDSC that's making the cancer worse, and you know the killer T cells and you know CD8's gonna get lower, and that's what he observed. But when he actually does the operation, he did find that that recovers the cancer immunity. So this is another excellent example that even for the clinician standpoint, well, this is called reverse translational research, but your tag and team with a PhD can make that study one level up. Finally, if you want to be an independent researcher, you cannot dodge grants. You need to get grants. You need to have independent funding to be an independent scientist. Now, NIH grants are the kind of a determining factor to become independent, and these are the items that you need to score high. Now, in a NIH grant world, what does significance mean? Significance means that how is this useful for the patients? That's what it goes down to. And that's where the PhDs can use the clinician. And this is the last slide, but this is what I love to see. So this is one of my PhD friend he approached me when I arrived. By the way, I just came here like 10 months ago. So right about summer, he approached me, and he is even from like biomedical engineering. And so what he was proposing initially was he can kind of calculate the texture of the tissue by mammography. Okay? So what he was proposing was that before the operation, he does the calculation and tells the surgeon how hard it is before surgery. I mean, that may be scientifically cool, but for a surgeon, do I even care? I mean, how hard it is? I mean, you know, it doesn't really change anything. So I thought that idea was not interesting. However, in a clinical practice, there is a huge problem that Dr. Young just told you, in DCIS. DCIS, very benign, among the cancers is very benign. But among the BCIS, it's 30% that true cancer is hidden in there, and the current mammogram can be missed. Now, using his new technology, can we detect that? And his answer was yes. So I thought, using exactly the same methodology, exactly the same experiment, but instead of proposing that he can figure out the stiffness of the tissue before the operation to help surgeons, versus, well, his new technology can detect this hidden cancer among DCIS, then we don't have to do that big operation for DCIS patients. That sounds a lot more relevant for cancer care and making the patients live longer. So that's how we pitched his grant, and like a week ago, or 3 days ago, 4 days ago, apparently he was awarded. So I think this is a, you know, the kind of like a thing that we want to keep on doing with both the basic researchers and our clinicians, like complementing with their own strength. Because once again, I didn't invent any of what he does, but he was really not aware what was so important and what was the barrier in clinical practice. So both of us can put our expertise all in the pot, and I think many cool things can happen. So that was what I wanted to tell, but all the, you know, the learning portion was done by Dr. Young, and so I wish you guys a successful career, and thank you for listening.